Hey everyone, welcome to another deep dive. Today we're going to be taking a deep dive into the history of biblical interpretation.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be a long one,
Yeah.
but it's super interesting.
It is.
And we're going to be mainly focusing on a lecture by Dr. Dave Matthewson.
Okay.
And he really gets into the nitty-gritty of hermeneutics, which is a fancy word for how we interpret things, especially when it comes to the Bible.
Right. A lot of people don't realize that no one interprets the Bible on their own.
Yeah.
Like, we're all part of this giant conversation that goes all the way back to the beginning.
So you're saying like the Bible even interprets itself?
Yeah, in a way. Like, if you think about the New Testament authors, they're constantly going back to the Old Testament and saying, like, see, this is what it all meant.
Right.
They saw Jesus as like the ultimate fulfillment of all these prophecies and
Oh,
pattern.
that's so interesting. So they're reading the Old Testament with this whole extra layer of meaning that we might miss if we just read it on its own.
Exactly. And it's not just like a one-to-one thing, you know.
Right.
Sometimes they saw a prophecy as like literally coming true. Like
Got
when Micah said the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem, and then Matthew's like, boom, there it is, Jesus in Bethlehem.
Right.
But then there's this other approach too, like what Dr. Matthewson calls typological fulfillment.
Okay, what is that?
It's a little more complex. It's not just about predicting the future, but more about revealing deeper patterns. You know how God works throughout history. Like Matthew connects Hosea's words about God calling Israel out of Egypt to the story of Jesus and his family escaping to Egypt when he was a kid.
Wait, so they're saying those two events are like connected somehow.
Yeah. Not like a straight up repeat, but like a prefigurement, you know?
Man.
It's like God Bobbis working in these similar ways, and Jesus is like the climax of it all.
Oh, I see.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. So it wasn't just the New Testament writers doing this, right?
No, not at all. Early Jewish interpreters, the rabbis, they had all sorts of methods for interpreting scripture, and those methods had a big influence on the early Christians too. Like what, give me an example.
Well, one technique was arguing from lesser to greater.
Okay.
You see Jesus doing this in Matthew when he says, if God takes care of the birds, he'll definitely take care of us too.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a really powerful way to make a point.
It is.
And they also connected texts through shared vocabulary, you know, like finding hidden links and deeper meanings in the specific words that were used. You
Wow.
can see this in Hebrews, where the author is constantly making connections back to the Old Testament.
Right.
And speaking of early Christians, we get a glimpse into their interpretive methods through the writings of the apostolic fathers.
Oh, yeah.
People like Clement, Polycarp, Ignatius,
Yeah.
they were all wrestling with how to apply these ancient scriptures to their own lives.
It's amazing to think that we're still grappling with those same questions today.
I know it's wild. But one thing that always fascinates me about early interpretation is the rise of allegory.
Oh yeah, allegory. That's where things get a bit
Symbolic, yeah.
yeah.
Instead of taking the Bible literally, they started looking for all these hidden spiritual meanings behind the text.
It's like reading a parable, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a deeper message beyond the surface story.
Right. So who are some of the big names in allegory?
Well, Philo was one of the early champions. He was really into Greek philosophy, and he used those ideas to reinterpret the Old Testament in a whole new way.
Okay.
But it was Origen who really took it to another level. He believed that scripture actually had three layers of meaning: the literal, the moral, and the spiritual.
Whoa, hold on. Three different meanings for every story? How did they even figure that out?
It gets kind of tricky there. Origen actually thought that finding those deeper allegorical meanings was a sign of, you know, like intellectual and spiritual maturity.
Interesting. That's a bit different from how we approach it today.
Yeah, for sure. To get a sense of how he used allegory, think about his interpretation of Lot and his daughters.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a story I've always found a bit.
Unsettling.
Yeah, a bit unsettling.
Yeah, but Origen doesn't just take it at face value. He interprets Lot as representing the human mind, his wife as the flesh, and his daughters as pride.
Wow. Okay, that is a lot to unpack.
Right, but it shows you how they were trying to find spiritual significance, even in stories that are, as you said, a little difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of finding spiritual significance, we can't forget about Saint Augustine.
Oh, of course. His interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan is like the classic example of allegory in
It's
action.
like the parable becomes this big puzzle to solve.
Yeah. I remember learning about how he saw the man who was beaten up as representing Adam Jerusalem, as the heavenly city Jericho as mortality, the robbers as the devil and his angels. It's so
Yes,
intricate.
he's crazy. And what's really wild is that he interprets the Samaritan who is despised by the Jews as a symbol of Christ.
Right. That's a bold move.
It is. I mean, you can see why allegory was so appealing.
Oh, yeah.
Even if we don't use it in the same way today,
yeah.
It's clear that people have always been trying to find meaning in these ancient stories and connect them to their own lives.
Exactly. And that desire for relevance is going to play a key role in the next chapter of our story, the Reformation.
Ooh, the Reformation.
That's when things really start to get shaken up.
I can't wait. But we'll have to save that for part two of our deep dive.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. All right. Welcome back to the deep dive. Last time we were exploring those early interpretations of the Bible and all that allegory stuff.
Oh, yeah. Things were getting pretty symbolic, weren't they?
Totally.
Yeah.
But as we teased, the Reformation is about to, like, shake things up big time.
Oh, yeah. Buckle up. The Reformation was a major turning point. It wasn't just about, you know, religious doctrine. It totally changed how people approached the Bible itself.
Dr. Matthewson mentioned this idea of historical consciousness becoming a big deal during this time. What does it even mean?
It's basically realizing that the past is like a different country,
yeah.
You know? To really get the Bible, you got to try to understand the historical context it was written in.
So no more reading it through the lens of our own time and culture.
Exactly. It's like putting yourself in the sandals of the original audience, you know? And this wasn't just some random idea. It came from all these new discoveries in archaeology and history and even anthropology.
Really?
Yeah.
So, like, what kind of discoveries were changing the game?
Well, think about the Ten Commandments. For centuries, people saw them as totally unique, you know, revolutionary even.
Yeah.
But then archaeologists unearthed all these ancient law codes, like the Code of Hammurabi.
Hammurabi. Now, that name rings a bell. Wasn't he like some Mesopotamian king or something?
That's the one. And his law code, which is way older than the Ten Commandments, has all these surprising similarities.
Like what?
Stuff like theft, adultery, even false accusations. All things you find in the Ten Commandments, too.
So does that mean the Ten Commandments weren't that important after all?
No, not at all. It's more like it challenges that idea that they were totally unprecedented. You know, they were part of this bigger legal tradition in the ancient world. And understanding that context actually helps us appreciate them in a whole new way.
So basically, archaeology was like throwing shade on those old interpretations.
You could say that. And it wasn't just archaeology. Literary criticism had a huge impact, too.
Okay, wait. Hold on. I think I actually get this one. It's like you wouldn't read a poem the same way you'd read a history textbook, right?
You got it. Literary critics developed all these tools for analyzing texts, you know, looking at things like genre structure, the author's intent. Mm-hmm. And biblical scholars were like, hey, we can use these tools, too.
So they started, like, dissecting the Bible like it was some Shakespearean sonnet?
Kind of. And they made some crazy discoveries. Like, for instance, they realized that many books of the Bible were actually compilations of earlier sources.
Whoa, what?
Yeah, not the work of just one single author. Like, think about the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. It wasn't just Moses sitting down and writing them all at once.
That changes things.
It does. It's like finding out your favorite novel is actually written by a committee. And that raises all sorts of questions about authorship and authority and how the Bible even came together in the first place.
Yeah. Wow.
Then you've got form criticism, another big development.
Like, break it down for me. What's form criticism all about?
It's all about looking at the different types of literature in the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, recognizing that a psalm, a proverb, a historical account, those are all different genres, and you got to approach them differently.
Right, like you wouldn't interpret a love poem the same way you would a battle cry.
Exactly. Form criticism helps us understand the original purpose of these different parts of the Bible.
Right.
Like, psalms were meant to be sung, proverbs were little nuggets of wisdom, parables were stories with a point. It makes the Bible feel so much more alive, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure. It's not just some dusty old book. It's like this collection of different voices and styles all coming together.
Right. But context still matters. You can't just ignore the historical situation.
Of course not. Yeah. So is that where fields like anthropology and sociology come in?
Bingo. Scholars start to realize you can't understand the Bible without understanding the social and cultural world it was written in. Things like family structures, social hierarchies, economic systems, the role of women, it all plays a part.
Okay, so walk me through an example. How does this social and cultural stuff actually change how we interpret things?
Take the way women are portrayed in the Bible. For a long time, people just accepted those portrayals as like, well, that's just how it was.
Yeah.
But when you understand the patriarchal nature of ancient Israelite society, you start to see things differently.
Hmm. You mean those portrayals might just be reflecting the culture of the time, not necessarily God's ideal for women?
That's a huge question, and it shows how understanding the social context can challenge our assumptions and even make us rethink those traditional interpretations.
Wow, my brain is doing backflips over here. All these different fields, all these new ways of looking at the Bible. It's a lot to take in.
It is, and honestly, it can be kind of overwhelming. You know, there's no one right way to interpret the Bible, and for some people, that can be unsettling.
Yeah, I get that. If there's no single right answer, doesn't that mean anyone can just, like, make up their own meaning?
That's a valid concern, for sure. And it's something scholars wrestle with all the time. But here's the thing. Even with all these different approaches and interpretations, there are still some common threads that run through most modern scholarship.
Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah.
So what are some of those shared principles?
One of the big ones is this commitment to what we call historical critical methods. It's all about using evidence and reason, carefully analyzing the text in its historical and literary context. It's like being a detective, you know?
Trying to piece together the clues to figure out what the author was really trying to say.
Exactly. So no more just reading a verse and saying, this is what it means to me. You got to do the work, dig into the history, consider the genre, all that jazz.
Right.
And this approach has helped us appreciate just how complex and diverse the Bible really is. It's not this monolithic book with one single message. You know, it's a collection of writings from different times and places reflecting a whole range of perspectives and beliefs.
So it's like a tapestry woven together from all these different threads. Beautiful, but complicated.
Beautiful. And because of that complexity, we have to accept that there are tensions and ambiguities within the text. We can't just force it into a neat little box.
It's more about wrestling with those tough passages, sitting with the discomfort, and maybe even coming away with more questions than answers.
That's it. But here's another key principle. The reader matters too. You can't pretend you're just some neutral observer when you're reading the Bible. Your own experiences, your background, your beliefs, they all shape how you understand the text.
So two people could read the same passage and come away with totally different interpretations. That sounds kind of chaotic.
It can be, but it also means there's room for dialogue and community. We don't interpret the Bible in isolation. We do it in conversation with others, sharing our insights, challenging each other, and learning from different perspectives.
Like we're all part of this giant conversation about the Bible, and everyone has something to contribute.
That's a beautiful way to put it. But even with all this complexity and nuance, we can't lose sight of the fact that biblical interpretation isn't just some academic exercise.
Yeah.
You know, it's about engaging with the Bible in a way that's personally meaningful and transformative.
It's about letting the Bible speak to our lives, challenge us, comfort us, and even inspire us to live differently.
Exactly. But how do we bridge that gap between that ancient world and our own modern complex world? That's a question we'll explore in the final part of our deep dive.
Welcome back to the deep dive. We've gone from ancient allegory to the Reformation and explored all that modern scholarship has to offer. But like, where do we go from here? How do we even apply all this to our lives today in the 21st century?
That is the big question, isn't it? And there's no easy answer, especially now when there's just so much information out there, so many different perspectives and voices.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's one thing to talk about different interpretations with scholars, you know, people who are kind of on the same page. But today, you've got all these different perspectives on the Bible coming from different cultures, different faiths. How do we even begin to have a conversation when we're starting from such different places?
That's a tough one. I think we need a major shift in how we approach these conversations.
Like what?
More humility, for one. Recognizing that we don't have all the answers.
Right.
Our own perspective is just one piece of the puzzle. We have to be willing to really listen to others and learn from them, even when we disagree.
So less talking, more listening. Less I'm right, you're wrong, and more help me understand where you're coming from.
Exactly. We need to get past that my way or the highway kind of thinking and embrace all the richness and complexity that comes from engaging with different perspectives.
You mentioned postmodernism last time as being a big challenge for biblical interpretation today. Can you unpack that a bit? Yeah. It sounds kind of intimidating.
I know, right? It can feel like you're stepping into this deep philosophical abyss. But essentially, postmodernism challenges this idea that there's one single objective truth. It says that our understanding of the world, even our understanding of the Bible, is shaped by all sorts of things. Our language, our culture, the power structures around us.
So there's no neutral way to read the Bible. Everyone's bringing their own baggage to the table.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that can be both exciting and scary. On the one hand, it frees us from those old traditional interpretations and lets us explore the Bible in new creative ways.
Right.
But on the other hand, it raises all these questions about the authority of the Bible and whether it can really speak definitively about, you know, faith and how we should live.
Yeah, it's like the ground is shifting under our feet. How do we even know what to believe anymore?
It's definitely a challenge. But even with all this uncertainty, I think there are some really cool things happening in biblical interpretation today.
Like what?
Well, one of the most exciting things is this growing awareness of marginalized voices in the interpretive process.
You mean like hearing from people who haven't traditionally had a seat at the table?
Mm-hmm.
Women, people of color, LGBTQ plus folks?
That's right. For too long, biblical interpretation has been dominated by, you know, white, Western, male voices. But as we become more aware of the diversity of human experience, we're realizing that we need to include a wider range of perspectives.
It's like we've been looking at the Bible through this tiny keyhole, and now we're finally opening the door and letting all the light in.
What a beautiful image. And it's not just about being politically correct either. Including these diverse voices actually helps us understand the Bible better and hear its message in new and profound ways.
So it's not about throwing out those traditional interpretations, but more about broadening the conversation, adding more layers to our understanding. Like the more voices we hear, the richer the tapestry becomes.
I love that. And on top of that, we're also seeing this huge increase in the accessibility of biblical scholarship.
How so?
Thanks to the internet and technology resources that used to be available only to academics are now available to pretty much anyone.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. It's like democratizing biblical knowledge.
Yeah.
You don't need a PhD to engage with the Bible on a deeper level.
Right. And I think that has the potential to totally change the way we understand and interpret the Bible. It helps us move past those simplistic interpretations and engage with the text in a way that's more nuanced and thoughtful.
So it's like empowering everyone to be their own interpreters instead of just relying on what they've been told.
Exactly. And with those tools, we can go beyond just understanding the text to actually living it out.
So it's not just about head knowledge. It's about letting it transform our hearts and actions.
Absolutely. It's about asking ourselves, how does my interpretation of the Bible shape how I live? How I treat others, how I interact with the world around me.
So it's like the Bible's a map, but it's up to us to actually take the journey to walk the path.
I like that. And that journey takes both humility and courage. Humility to know that we don't have all the answers and that we might be wrong, and courage to ask those tough questions, to challenge those old interpretations, and to live out what we believe even when it's hard.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one question you would want our listeners to ask themselves as they continue exploring the Bible in our crazy mixed up world?
That's a good one. I think each of us needs to wrestle with what it means to be a faithful and responsible interpreter of the Bible in our own lives. You know, what values and principles are we taking from it? And how are we putting those into practice in the real world? It's a lifelong journey for sure, and it's one we take together.
Well said. Thanks for joining us on this incredible deep dive into the history of biblical interpretation. We hope we've learned something new and maybe even come away with some new questions to ponder. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep seeking deeper understanding. Until next time.